It's fun local features on the Lifestyle Show. At 8, join us for Arts and Letters Live from the Dallas Museum of Art, a literary and performing arts series for all ages that features award-winning authors and performers combining arts, music, and film. At 9, it's a look at the past on the History Book Hour. At 10, fiction books on the Armchair Adventure Hour. And at 11, Phil Parr and his buddies from Lufkin, Texas, show us how to do it ourselves on The Blind Handyman. That's all coming up tonight, beginning at 7, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 75 and partly cloudy. Tonight, scattered thunderstorms with a low in the low 60s. Then, tomorrow, thunderstorms with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, scattered thunderstorms with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
If it's in Texas, it's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm KC Jobe, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on site and to sound broadcasting. Our first article will be from our brand new fresh May issue, and we'll open with the editor's letter, one from Dan Goodgame. From the headline from the editor, May 2020, it's all been a blur. When we started planning this issue months ago, we had a fun lineup in mind, including a beautiful cover story on sport fishing, and then oil prices crashed, and the coronavirus brought much of the state to a standstill. This double whammy poses a huge challenge to all Texans, including Texas Monthly staff, been working remotely to make sense of it all for readers, especially on TexasMonthly.com, where our round-the-clock coverage of the coronavirus crisis is available for free to everyone. Leading that online effort is our website's new editorial director, Michelle Williams, who moved to Texas in March and dived immediately into the fray. I unpacked my boxes, but I don't remember how, she says. It's all been a blur. I haven't really thought of anything else besides this story. A veteran of CNN and the Washington Post, Michelle's been leading a team of staffers to sort through dozens of possible stories each day and pursue the ones where we can add the most value for readers. One example overseen by executive editor Kathy Blackwell is Dan Solomon and Paula Forbes' inspiring tale of how HEB diligently planned for the pandemic, which became the most popular story we've ever posted. Michelle's predecessor, Megan Crite, has been working just as creatively in her new role as our new story platforms editor, helping plan our live events and multimedia efforts. Most of our events postponed indefinitely, Megan and other staffers are finding novel ways to deliver their content to our audiences. One example is Texas Monthly Bedtime Stories, a video series in which our writers read aloud some of our best pieces from their homes. You never know when a child or pet might wander into the frame. Megan and colleagues have also arranged for several popular Texas musicians, some of whom are scheduled to perform at an event we'd planned for Austin's canceled South by Southwest Festival, to perform instead via video from their homes. Covering a dual crisis as fast-moving as this one presents a different challenges for a monthly print magazine. Fast Pick and the Dining Guide, for instance, and no longer made sense for this issue. Our approach has been to go deep. In his cover story, senior editor Eric Benson explains exactly how the coronavirus outpaced Texas's attempts to get ahead of it. To accompany Eric's piece, design director Emily Kimbrough, and art director Victoria Milner, and photo editor Claire Hogan deployed 7 photographers to capture arresting images, including ones of Texas locales that resemble ghost towns. But we know our readers don't live by COVID-19 updates alone. We've included in this issue a selection of Texas-flavored books, movies, streaming series, music, and recipes that you can enjoy while you're hunkered down. More recommendations are available at TexasMonthly.com, and that fishing story may have gotten bumped off the cover, but it's still here, as is a smart profile of the author, Paulette Giles. Hope you enjoy this issue and that you'll share with me what you're experiencing during this crisis at roar@texasmonthly.com. This little bit here, the stand-up desk, introducing the newest members of Texas Monthly's editorial staff. Texas Monthly welcomed its most recent editorial hire this week. Rose K. Hallen joined as the associate digital editor for culture and lifestyle coverage. K. A. Allen was most recently worked at the Texas Observer, where she served as managing editor. Before that, she worked at Alcalde, the University of Texas alumni magazine. She grew up in Pennsylvania, but got back to Texas as soon as she could, earning a B.A. in English at Rice University. A. Allen is the latest in a talented group of editorial staffers who have joined the magazine since late last year and are enabling it to expand in news coverage and storytelling on the website, which set a new record for traffic in March, as well as via videos and podcasts. First up, Taylor Pruitt started work last week as our social media editor. She came to Texas Monthly from Creative Action, a nonprofit focused on youth development, where she managed the organization's social media strategy. Native Texan from Navasota and a UT alum. Elena Betty became Texas Monthly's newsletter editor in early April and has already helped launch a new email newsletter, Staying In With TM. Betty has been working at Schumacher, a design company based in New York City, where she served as director of digital marketing. She previously worked as the digital editor of T, the New York Times style magazine, and as an associate editor at WSJ Magazine, published by the Wall Street Journal. While Christopher Hooks may be a familiar name for Texas Monthly readers, he has written dozens of articles over the years for Texas Monthly. He joined the staff as a full-time writer this month. He's written for many other publications as a freelancer, including the American Prospect, Mother Jones, New York Times, and the Washington Post. He's also worked as a full-time politics writer for the Texas Observer and a fellow for the Texas Tribune. Michelle Williams came aboard in early March as editorial director of TexasMonthly.com and quickly dived into the fray of covering the coronavirus crisis. She moved to Austin from Atlanta, where she'd served as an assignment editor and producer for the digital content of CNN's affiliate service. Before that, she worked at the Washington Post, first as a web producer and digital editor, and then as an assignment editor. Lauren Larson joins Texas Monthly as a features editor. She's been freelancing in New York City for a year as an editor and writer. During that time, she wrote for GQ, Men's Health, and The New Yorker, among other publications. Before that, she was an editor at GQ, where she worked as an editorial assistant, assistant editor, and an associate editor. Ben Rowan moved from Santa Barbara, California to Austin to become our associate digital editor for news and politics. He'd worked at The Atlantic as an editorial fellow, then moved to Pacific Standard, where he's promoted from associate editor to national editor. And just before the start of 2020, Peter Holly joined Texas Monthly as a senior editor. Holly is an Austin native and seventh-generation Texan, and had previously worked for Houstonia Magazine, Houston Chronicle, and San Antonio Express News. He joined Texas Monthly from the Washington Post, where he worked with Ms. Williams, focusing most recently on technology and innovation. Now based in Houston, where he writes about city, business, and entrepreneurship statewide. We now turn to the state, this section, and up first is news and politics. This first article, Texas officials were warned 6 years ago to prepare for a pandemic. They didn't. This is by Eric Benson. And let's see. Warren Lee wasn't particularly worried about the coronavirus. Back then, few were. It was mid-January, and the 29-year-old Dallas area resident was visiting his girlfriend in the Chinese city of Wuhan, where they planned to celebrate the Lunar New Year. Lee, who was launching an esports startup, had begun tracking online whispers about the new virus earlier that month, but he remembers everyone was taking it fairly lightly. Lee was, too. He and his girlfriend, whom he'd met through video game circles, had recently flown to Seoul to attend a stadium concert headlined by the reconstituted British rock band Queen, then returned to get ready for the New Year's festivities. "We were just loafing around doing nothing," Lee told me, and that's when everything got fired up. On the night of January 22nd, Lee's girlfriend saw a post on the Chinese social media platform Weibo. The government would be quarantining the entire city of 11 million people. All flights and trains out of Wuhan were canceled, and the public transport inside city limits would be suspended. Lee and his girlfriend had already stocked up on provisions for the holiday, a lot of ramen and hot pots, so they hunkered down at her apartment and spent most of their time watching movies and playing their Nintendo Switch. On the fourth day of the quarantine, Lee filmed an 8-minute YouTube vlog showing empty streets and a convenience store with shelves still full of instant noodles. Lee had water and heat and internet, and he and his girlfriend had been routinely taking their temperatures. Didn't have fevers. "It's not the apocalypse out here as much as people have been saying," he explained. "I'm okay, but I'm kind of figuring out what the day-to-day is going to be like." When I Skyped with Lee on March 24th, he was 2 months into quarantine. He projected a kind of droll resignation, occasionally sucking on a vape and glancing off camera at his girlfriend as she played Animal Crossing. From his perch at the epicenter of the pandemic, Lee had watched the coronavirus's relentless global advance. Its progress was slow at first. We heard about a couple cases in Hong Kong and Korea and Japan, he said, and at that point it's like, okay, so it's trickling in there. As the outbreak expanded, Lee grew frustrated. Forward march of the disease was predictable, inevitable, but each newly affected country seemed to react as if it were being hit by an unforeseen calamity. You keep hoping that it's like maybe these people will take the hint and they will get their stuff sorted out as fast as they can to stop it. Lee talked regularly with his family and friends back home, and in late February, as it became clear that the coronavirus was spreading through the United States, he told his mother, who lives in the mid-cities west of Dallas, it might be there. Just stay inside. It's not safe. She listened. His friends, mostly millennial gamers, heeded his warnings, too. They know how seriously I've been taking things here, and I was like, hey, all you need to do is stay at home and play Doom Eternal or League of Legends. By the time Lee and I talked, Wuhan and Dallas were trending in opposite directions. The Chinese government had just announced that it would lift its travel restrictions on Wuhan on April 8th. And the most populated counties in Texas had just announced they were issuing stay-home, work-safe orders for their residents. Lee isn't a public health expert, but given his unique vantage point, I was curious why he thought the world had been a step behind the virus from the start. No one wants to admit that they're in the middle of a really, really, really bad situation, Lee said. The thing is, even when it was happening in the States, that sounds like a Seattle problem, or that sounds like a San Francisco problem. It doesn't sound like a Dallas problem. On the same day, Lee's girlfriend read on Weibo about the impending lockdown in Wuhan. A Texas A&M student who had recently returned to the United States from Wuhan checked into a Brazoria County emergency room with mild symptoms consistent with an upper respiratory infection. Doctors swabbed the patient and shipped the samples to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta to test for the coronavirus. As soon as news of the possible case broke the next day in the local CBS affiliate, KBTX, residents of Bryan and College Station began snatching up protective masks within hours. Area stores were out of stock. Over the next several days, state health officials investigated three other suspected cases of the new disease, which was still 2 weeks away from being named COVID-19. On Monday, January 27th, the Texas Department of State Health Services announced that the results of the four tests had come back. They were all negative. Once the brief panic subsided, there were plenty of reasons for anyone reading the news to feel assured that our worst fears were overblown. On the day the Texas tests were revealed to be negative, the New York Times reported that the United States has seen only 5 positive tests so far. That same week, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the World Health Organization, said that he was most concerned about the virus spreading to less developed countries with weaker health systems which are ill-prepared to deal with it. In the States, experts urged us to wash our hands and worry instead about the seasonal flu. Kaiser Health News published a story titled Something Far Deadlier Than the Wuhan Virus Lurks Near You, and an article in the Washington Post admonished America, using a pun for the French word for influenza, to get a grip. The flu is a much bigger threat than coronavirus for now. Even Peter Hotez, a leading vaccine researcher who serves as the dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine, Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, downplayed the threat, telling CBS Austin, flu is a major killer of Americans, and I guarantee you it will kill more Americans by order of magnitude than what will happen with this novel coronavirus. State officials claimed they had the situation under control. On January 30th, DSHS spokesperson Chris Van Dusen told the Texas Tribune, one of the advantages we have in this situation is we know it's there, we know what it looks like, and have the test to identify it. For a time, Van Dusen's comment sounded reasonable. CDC reported Texas's first case of COVID-19 on February 13th, but it came with a big asterisk. The infected individual had been evacuated from Wuhan to Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio and hadn't interacted with the general population. By the beginning of March, 11 of the country's 74 confirmed COVID-19 cases were in Texas, but all of them were U.S. residents who had returned from overseas and were in quarantine at Lackland. One Wuhan evacuee, it turned out, had been released from quarantine prematurely, checking into a Holiday Inn Express and walking around San Antonio's North Star Mall before authorities realized her last coronavirus test had come back with a weak positive result. She is not believed to have transmitted the virus to anyone. For most of us, though, the crisis still seemed like something that's happening elsewhere. Sure, the producer and distributors of the latest James Bond movie, eyeing an already reeling global market, delayed the film's release date from April to November. And yes, the top Italian soccer league had already begun suspending matches. We carried on like life in Texas and across the country would be fine so long as we didn't import the problem. On March 1st, when organizers of the Houston Energy Conference Zero Week canceled the event a few days before it was to begin, they cited growing concern about large conferences with people coming from different parts of the world. Zero Week was slated to draw delegates from more than 80 countries. After Austin Mayor Steve Adler called off the South by Southwest Festival on March 6th, he said that he was particularly concerned by the fact that the event was such an international draw. In 2019, South by Southwest attracted some 400,000 attendees from 105 countries. To blunt the economic blow, Adler promoted the Stand with Austin campaign, posting a video on Twitter in which he, Travis County Judge Sarah Eckhart, and State Senator Kirk Watson asked Austinites to help local restaurateurs and entertainers go out to eat, drink, listen to live music, Adler wrote. The tweet has been deleted. The following Monday, March 9th, Adler told Texas Monthly's Andy Langer that he was still going out and thought other Austinites should feel safe to do so too. Austin's health officer, Adler said, had described coronavirus as resembling a hurricane in the Gulf. The storm clouds were forming above us, but landfall didn't seem imminent. There's no reason for people not to gather in our town, the mayor said. 2 days later, it became clear that the storm was already here. The World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic in Montgomery County, north of Houston. Health officials announced that they believed that a man who tested positive for the coronavirus had contacted it through community spread, meaning that the source of the infection was unknown. It was the first known instance in the state. Confirmation the virus was now moving through the population. By that afternoon, Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo had shut down and cleared its attendees out of NRG Stadium. That night, President Donald Trump announced a travel ban on flights coming from Europe, and Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban, sitting courtside at American Airlines Arena, stared slack-jawed at his phone as the news broke that Utah Jazz center Rudy Gobert had tested positive for the coronavirus and the NBA had suspended its season. Within 24 hours, the NCAA canceled March Madness, and Major League Baseball suspended spring training and delayed opening day. That Sunday night, Eddie F. Roberts, a 97-year-old mortician from Bay City, became the first Texan to die of the disease. In a sign of the times, Roberts' family decided against giving the longtime funeral director his own service for safety reasons. Even as it became clear that the coronavirus was a new fact of life, the disease continued to outrun us. On February, March 20, 5 days after the death of Roberts, Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner and Police Chief Art Acevedo held a press conference to dispel rumors that the city was on the verge of a lockdown. Acevedo blamed the hearsay on a hostile foreign government, and Turner announced that he was asking the Houston Police Department and the Harris County District Attorney's Office to investigate a possible disinformation campaign intended to panic the populace. Just 3 days later, the hashtag Houston Lockdown was trending on Twitter, with citizens begging the city's leader to enact more aggressive restrictions. The next morning on March 24th, Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo mandated that residents stay home unless they were leaving to buy groceries, exercise, or do what was deemed essential work. Within 2 days, a total of 17 million Texans, nearly 60% of the state's population, were under similar orders. How did it come to this? Why did we seem so surprised at every turn? Texas officials had no excuse to be blindsided. In October 2014, after a Liberian man named Thomas Eric Duncan was diagnosed with Ebola virus at a Dallas hospital, Governor Rick Perry created the Texas Task Force on Infectious Disease Preparedness and Response. The group's 174-page report on the Ebola crisis, submitted that December, begins with this epigraph. In today's globally connected society, an infectious disease epidemic anywhere can soon become an emergency everywhere. And Duncan, who died from Ebola, had infected two nurses at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, both of whom survived, and the task force zeroed in on the importance of personal protective equipment for medical staff. The Ebola crisis, they wrote, revealed a shortage of PPE that is vitally needed by hospital workers, including those who may find themselves unexpectedly in an emergency department with an Ebola patient or similar patient with a high-consequence infectious disease. They recommended the state create a stockpile of such equipment in case of a future outbreak. Governor Perry praised the report, and Republican State Senator Charles Schwertner tried to codify some of the task force recommendations, including the PPE stockpile, into law. The bill passed the Senate, but it wasn't taken up by the House until the final month of the 2015 legislative session, and it never got a hearing in the Public Health Committee. Today's state leaders, even while facing the dire threat of a pandemic raging throughout the state, haven't responded with much greater urgency. In January and February, while the CDC was failing to institute a widespread testing program, state leaders were uncertain about the scope and trajectory of the problem. When the state's Infectious Disease Task Force met in early February, DSHS Commissioner John Hellerstedt likened the unfolding crisis to the fog of war. When you have a rapidly developing situation, when there are a great many factors at work, being able to see clearly is sometimes simply not possible, he said. But even after the spread of coronavirus throughout the state became clear, the official response lagged. On March 10th, Hellerstedt told the Texas House Public Health Committee that Texas must show the world how this is done. Instead, Governor Greg Abbott has constantly trailed behind city and county officials, not to mention other state governors of both parties, resisting calls for more stringent statewide regulations by arguing that what is appropriate for hard-hit metropolises might not be right for rural areas that had yet to see their first positive test. This may have sounded reasonable enough, but on the ground it didn't make sense so long as Texans were free to travel across county lines. In Dallas, for example, County Judge Clay Jenkins' stay-at-home order, the first in the state, shuttered many businesses and severely curtailed residents' activities, while neighboring Collin County allowed all businesses to stay open because, Collin County Judge Chris Hill asserted, all businesses and all jobs and all workers are essential. It took Abbott until the last day of March to issue a de facto stay-at-home order that made regulations more uniform. What was the point of waiting for the situation to get so bad when an earlier stay-at-home order might have saved lives? At least Abbott had spent the previous weeks gradually shuttering public spaces, ordering increased hospital capacity, and strongly advising Texans to limit their social interactions. Other state leaders have been less constructive. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick made an instantly infamous appearance on Fox News, in which he suggested that senior citizens, including himself, should be willing to risk a painful death of intubation and fluid-filled lungs in order to get Americans back to work. Senator John Cornyn has helpfully contributed to public discourse by tweeting a photo of a Corona beer with the words, "Be smart, don't panic," and blaming Chinese culture for the viral outbreak because that nation's citizens eat bats and snakes and dogs and things like that. Attorney General Ken Paxton seized the moment by making most abortions temporarily illegal. His order is now being adjudicated in federal appellate courts, while Tyler Congressman Louis Gohmert flirted with holding up a massive federal spending bill, reportedly after a conversation with President Donald Trump, he relented. In the absence of statewide leadership, local officials like Jenkins have been at the vanguard of the response, but even they haven't managed to get out in front of the crisis. San Antonio-based HEB was one of the few entities that was prepared to act fast. The supermarket chain created a pandemic influenza plan back in 2005 and began tailoring it to the coronavirus on February 2nd, 4 weeks before the first U.S. case of community spread. For nearly everyone else, the responses came too late. "This virus has made a mockery of our deliberations," Adler described his decision to cancel South by Southwest as easily the toughest of his 5 years as mayor. But even if Adler hadn't pulled the plug that Friday, it's unlikely the festival would have ever gotten underway. By the time South by Southwest was scheduled to begin, nearly every concert, sporting event, and conference in the country had been called off. The biggest difference between Austin, which as of press time has been spared the worst of the outbreak, and New Orleans, which became an epicenter of the virus in the United States, is a quirk of the calendar. Mardi Gras, which health experts suspect played a major role in the virus' spread, brought legions of tourists to New Orleans throughout February. South by Southwest was set to take place during the third week of March, a week later than it had been the previous year. If South by Southwest had been scheduled earlier, what would Austin and the rest of Texas look like now? If Texas somehow avoids the worst, it won't be because of Abbott's executive orders or even Jenkins' clear-eyed leadership. It'll be primarily because of dumb luck. As I write, things look bad enough. More than 150,000 Texans filed for unemployment during the third week of March, more than three times as many as the worst week during the Great Recession. The next week, that number nearly doubled to more than 275,000. The price of a barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude plummeted as far as $20, kneecapped by a price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia and whacked over the head with a lead pipe by a global drop in demand. The cost-intensive, debt-enabled fracking industry, which is already struggling to profit when oil was trading at $50 a barrel, may be shuttered indefinitely. The Brookings Institution, a center-left think tank in Washington, D.C., listed Midland, Odessa, and Laredo as three of the six U.S. metro areas most exposed to the economic cataclysm currently underway, with tens of thousands of oil workers already laid off. Having nearly one out of five residents uninsured, the worst rate in the nation, Texas's public health infrastructure is poorly equipped to weather a crisis that will push hospital resources to their capacity or well beyond it. For now, the strangeness of this crisis for most of us, sitting in our homes all day staring out at empty streets, is its invisibility. This isn't a hurricane arriving with biblical fury, flattening and flooding neighborhoods, and then leaving behind crystal clear skies and an all too clear social mission. Texans are used to that kind of roll up your sleeves challenge. Bouncing back from this disaster will prove far trickier. The threat will linger in our schools and theaters and nursing homes, in the lives of the millions of people who have lost jobs and thousands of families who have lost loved ones, and in every mundane interaction with neighbors and friends and family members that breaches 6 feet of personal space. Until a vaccine becomes available, perhaps 18 months from now, every handshake and hug will be tinged with the fear that an outbreak could flare up once again. When I spoke with Warren Lee, he told me he was eager to get home to Dallas. His mother, who lives alone, did not step outside her house for weeks, and he wanted to go grocery shopping for her. But Lee wasn't sure when that was going to happen. Wuhan would open up on April 8th, but he presumed that because he was a foreigner, he'd need additional paperwork before he was allowed to leave. The United States might not take him back immediately anyway, and even when he gets the all clear, he thinks it might be safer to wait. I'm still cautious about large flocks of people, Lee said. I'm probably going to wait for the first couple of waves to go through and then try to get back. It's hard to imagine if any of us will feel like we're truly back home. We're going to turn to the next story in just a minute, but first, I need to remind you of something. You're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sightings Down Broadcasting. Here marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. Listen to Sight into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. Yeah, turning now to that next story. This is in the news section of News and Politics. Houston is not prepared for the oil bust. Get those $400 fajitas while you can, because Houston's boom is over. Houston has survived its share of floods and hurricanes recently, but are we ready for the economic big one? By right, these self-proclaimed energy capital of the world is being hammered by twin crises. Saudis are flooding the market with crude in what they portray and his attempt to undercut Russia. Meanwhile, the coronavirus is suppressing demand. Houston is poorly prepared for this one-two punch. Evan Mintz, for all the boosterish rhetoric about our diversified economy, Greater Houston's economic success continues to heavily rely on the international consumption of oil. As of earlier this year, the energy industry dominated by oil and gas drove a third of the region's GDP and directly employed a quarter million workers. Crude now selling below $20 per barrel at the time of publication, Houston companies' revenues and employee counts are plummeting. Houston Chronicle reported that top fracking firms have cut more than $7 million from their collective 2020 budgets. Stories about layoffs and furloughs fill the headlines. And all this mayhem follows an already tenuous outlook for Houston's economy, which is supposed to be the year of oil and gas bankruptcies, even before life began to feel like a Roland Emmerich movie. International Energy Agency reported as early as February that global oil demand was falling, which hasn't happened since the Great Recession. The United States and Canada saw bankruptcies in the energy sector increase by 50% last year, and Dallas law firm Haynes and Boone, which monitors energy bankruptcies, predicted earlier this year that the trend line would continue throughout early 2020. Amid so-so oil prices, expensive overhead, and low cash flow, the only thing keeping many frackers afloat was debt, oceans of debt. It's all a bit reminiscent of the dot-com bubble of the late 1990s when internet companies were valued on the number of eyeballs they attracted, not on the profits they were likely to make. Bethany McLean, an author of books on Enron and the fracking boom, wrote in the New York Times, as long as investors were willing to believe that profits were coming, it all worked. Until it didn't. And that piece was published in 2018. Every good Houstonian knows that booms eventually turn to busts, and local leaders have been preparing for this moment, or at least they've been trying. Ed Herz, an economics lecturer and energy fellow at the University of Houston, spent years pitching the idea of a quota on oil imports into the United States, limiting the number of barrels that can be purchased from OPEC. Argues that a quota would stabilize oil prices and protect oil-related employment, the financial equivalent of a coastal storm surge barrier, safeguarding domestic producers from international oil and gas trouble. Some Republicans have embraced various policies to limit foreign oil imports. State Representative Drew Springer, who represents a rural district in the Panhandle in North Texas, tweeted in March that he favored a tariff, and U.S. Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota has expressed some support for an embargo. But bailing out the oil industry may not be so easy. Early draft of the $2 trillion stimulus package passed in March contained $3 billion for oil and gas companies. Democrats stripped out the aid, arguing that it amounted to a corporate giveaway. In January, at the Greater Houston Partnership's annual meeting, Chairman Bobby Tudor warned that economic change is coming to the Bayou City. The traditional oil and gas business is not likely to be the same engine for Houston's growth over the next 25 years that it's been in the past 25 years, he told the crowd in a Hilton America's Ballroom. When I spoke with Tudor in March, as West Texas Intermediate hovered around $26 a barrel, he emphasized that diversification is key to the city's long-term economic survival. One of the things this big downturn does remind us is actually how leveraged we really are to the energy business in Texas, he said. We talk a lot about how the economy is so much more diversified than it used to be, and my argument in the speech was, a little bit, not really, at least not for Houston. Tudor pointed to Rice University's ION project as an example of Houston's spotty efforts to diversify its economy. The project is meant to anchor a planned Midtown Innovation District, and the 270,000-square-foot facility housed in a former Sears store is supposed to serve as a nucleus for innovation in such fields as data science and digital technologies. Though it's scheduled to open in 2021, the ION still looks abandoned. Student activists who see the project as accelerating gentrification have been trying to wring concessions from university administrators, and an assessment by Ed Egan, formerly of Rice's McNair Center for Entrepreneurship and Economic Growth, determined that the project's backers were building the facility in the wrong part of town if they wanted to maximize the benefits of bringing startups closer together. In 2017, the Center for Houston's Future worked with the accounting firm KPMG to determine how much the city needed to diversify in order to maintain an outperforming economy in the face of rising threats to the fossil fuel industry. The report pointed to jobs in the data science industry as a way to sustain a regional economy, even in the worst-case scenario of a permanent oil and gas bust. Around the same time, the University of Texas System proposed the creation of a 332-acre data science campus on land it purchased south of the Astrodome. So where is that project today? The University of Houston helped quash the campus. Restaurant billionaire Tillman Fertitta, chairman of the UH System Board of Regents, called it an unnecessary duplication of resources. State Senator Don Whitmire, a Houston Democrat and UH alumnus, described the proposal as tantamount to spending $200 million on a dump. And so the UT system gave up and decided to sell the land. Houston will now presumably have to find another multi-million dollar project to stabilize its economy in the middle of a pandemic and an energy crisis. Meanwhile, Houston's budget is in no shape to absorb an economic shock. In March, City Controller Chris Brown released a stress test of Houston's municipal finances that outlined how the city would fare during a recession. Answer, not well. Despite a decade-long boom and money-saving pension reform, budgets remain unbalanced and the city routinely sells assets just to stay afloat. If we're lucky, the oil bust could turn out to be relatively short-lived and less painful than feared. Oil prices fell by nearly half in 2014, and Houston's economy rebounded in no time, partly because frackers learned how to pump oil more efficiently with less manpower. Compared with the 2014 employment peak, we're producing around 40% more oil with 20% fewer people. That's good for energy companies and their investors, but not so good for workers. Even if Houston recovers, our economy has already shifted. Most of the new jobs added after 2014 weren't the six-figure positions common in the industry. Instead, they were in restaurants, hotels, and healthcare, and the kind of gigs that don't necessarily offer good salaries or paid sick leave if the coronavirus forces you to stay home. With its prodigious intellect and industrial talent, Houston could become a leader in the renewable energy industry. The cost of delivering wind and solar energy have fallen thanks to persistent improvements in technology. A 2019 report by the International Renewable Energy Agency found that wind and solar energy are often less expensive than any fossil fuel option, even with the lavish subsidies enjoyed by oil, natural gas, and coal. No wonder, then, that 95% of the new capacity being added to the Texas electrical grid comes from solar, wind, and storage. When global demand bounces back, energy buyers may discover they've lost their appetite for Texas-made oil and natural gas, if only because the alternative is cheaper. The natural gas bridge fuel that was supposed to sustain Houston into the clean energy future may end up having a much shorter lifespan than the city had hoped, but Texas is blessed with plenty of sun and wind, and the nation's only statewide energy grid, and Houston is filled with expertise on the business side of energy. Still, oil and gas aren't going away overnight. Legacy infrastructure and vehicles will still rely on those fuels. Consumers will still buy plastic products and chemical fertilizer. Something happens when an industry transitions from growth to flatline. Energy experts know that the most important oil and gas pipeline was the virtual money tube from Wall Street to West Texas, and the lenders who financed much of the fracking were already tightening the spigot at the end of last year. If things get worse, investors will flee to better opportunities. Capital will dry up. The private equity-backed businesses that juice the Houston economy will start looking elsewhere, and so will workers. Whatever else it may become, Houston will still be an oil and gas town for many years. Detroit still manufactures cars. Pittsburgh still makes steel. Plenty of U.S. cities have accepted that their best years are behind them and supplemented their legacy industries by finding new economic equilibrium, one based to a great degree on, say, healthcare, higher education, a port, and a NASA facility. Cleveland, for example. I'm describing Cleveland. But who wants to live in Cleveland? It can be easy to dismiss concerns for Houston's future as hyperbolic, but they are exactly the worries that the city's biggest pro-business organization was talking about in January when its leaders thought the bust was years, if not decades, off. Before the coronavirus and the Saudi-Russian energy war attacked Houston like an economic Scylla and Charybdis. Last time the world saw anything as severe as the great present calamity was during the Great Recession. Amid that crisis in 2008, Houston was hit by Hurricane Ike. We still haven't built the coastal storm surge barrier that experts said we needed after Ike. As Houston suffers another localized disaster, economic, not meteorological, many may wonder if things will be different this time. Will Houston and Texas assume that oil prices will quickly bounce back as they always have? Or will we harness our considerable talent to diversify employment into areas such as wind and solar manufacturing, data analysis, and gene-based medicine? Either way, the Cajun Navy isn't going to get us out of this one. Next up, we've got one of our featured articles. This is about the travel and outdoors. It's actually part of the big fishing package they were going to do this issue. It's entitled, How a Battle Between Recreational and Commercial Fishermen Spawned a Conservation Movement. Redfish War Changed Texas Fishing. A Fight Over Flounder Could Be Next. On fall and winter nights, this is also by Wes Ferguson. and it's part of the Great Texas Fishing Safari Package. On fall and winter nights through the better part of the 20th century, Rudy Greiger would wade into Galveston Bay and listen to the roar of the redfish. Swimming in schools up to 500 strong, they sounded to him like freight trains churning through the dark. The closer they got, he recalled in a 1997 memoir, the louder the noise. Occasionally, the schools would plow right into Greiger, a pioneer of wade fishing in Texas, thumping against his legs and chest as he cast in the moonlight, trying his best to land two or three on a silver spoon lure before they swept past, and he'd wait for another school to come along. I'd repeat the process until I had a full stringer, Greiger wrote in Plugger, Wade Fishing in the Gulf Coast, a book that remains a saltwater angling Bible long after Greiger's death in 2001 at 86. Greiger, who owned a tackle shop in Houston, had been fishing in state shallow bays and estuaries since the Great Depression. In the early 70s, he was still landing countless bounties of redfish, also known as red drum, and up to 100 speckled trout in a day. By the end of that decade, though, the glory days had come to an end. Trout were in steep decline, and more than half the redfish had disappeared. Greiger blamed one culprit, commercial fishermen wielding lethally effective nets. Netters, he called them. Convinced that reds and specks were on the verge of extinction, the bison of the bays, Greiger hosted a gathering of 14 anglers at his tackle shop on February 15, 1977. The movement that grew out of that meeting would quickly spark an ugly fight between recreational and commercial fishermen, and ultimately spawn a conservation revolution that would change Texas fishing forever. The redfish wars had begun. Calling themselves the Gulf Coast Conservation Association, recreational anglers who'd convened at Greiger's tackle shop that day began raising money and lobbying state lawmakers to protect red drum and trout. They were powerful and well-connected. The group tapped Walter Fonder III, former star of the Texas Longhorn football team, to serve as founding chairman. Fonder was an avid fisherman whose grandfather was the founder of Humble Oil. Early GCCA members included Perry Bass and Oil Air, whose family owns all of San Jose Island, a barrier island near Port Aransas, and Bob Brister, then the influential outdoors editor of the Houston Chronicle. GCCA set its sights on the commercial netters whose fence-like gill nets they provide for emptying Texas bays and estuaries of redfish. Hundreds of miles of nets, they argued, were plucking thousands of mature bull reds from the water before they had a chance to produce enough offspring. Today, many people also blame the Gulf's plummeting numbers of red drum on the late New Orleans chef Paul Prudhon, who launched a culinary craze for blackened redfish when he invented the recipe in the mid-80s. In fact, red drum started vanishing from the coast years before Prudhon thought to sear butter-drenched fillets on a smoking hot cast iron. From 1976 to 1979, Texas commercial harvest of redfish dropped 65%, while trout landings fell more than 40%. Quite simply, there are too many people fishing a depleted resource. Bob Kemp, Texas Parks and Wildlife Fisheries Director in the GCCA Alley, concluded at the time, "There no longer are, or will be again, in my opinion, enough trout and redfish to meet the demands of both the commercial finfish industry and the recreational fishing industry." Sport anglers comprising the GCCA, later named the Coastal Conservation Association after the group spread to the east and west coasts, promptly scored a modest victory when the Texas legislature passed the Red Drum Conservation Act, 1977, which capped the daily harvest of red drum at 10 per recreational angler and 200 pounds for commercial fishermen. First time in the state's history that Texas had established daily bag limits for fish. Even so, the redfish and speckled trout catch didn't seem to improve all that much. In a subsequent legislative session, a group kept asking for more, including a ban on gill nets. 2 years later, the GCCA lobbied hard to ban the commercial harvesting of red drum and spotted sea trout by classifying both as game species like white-tailed deer. Pitted against wealthy sport fishermen, scores of workaday commercial netters erupted in bitter protests. They used their boats to form aquatic picket lines in an attempt to close the ports in Houston and Corpus Christi. Crew of a U.S. Coast Guard vessel surrounded by commercial fishermen shouting obscenities at them, blasted fire hoses to break through a picket line at the harbor entrance of Fort Mansfield. No way in hell would quit fishing, Bill Praker, a spokesman for a picket line along the Galveston Ship Channel, told Bob Brister, the outdoors writer and GCCA member for a story in Field and Stream. "This is our livelihood. Some of our people can't read or write." Greiger and others fielded death threats. Kemp found a pair of shotgun shells in his mailbox. "The netters wanted him to know they knew where he and his family lived," speculated Pat Murray, who watched redfish wars unfold as a young angler and later became president of the Coastal Conservation Association. One of the group's officials from Corpus Christi endured repeated warnings that his home and restaurant would be burned if he testified on behalf of the game fish bill, which had been introduced in the legislature in 1981. "He testified, and someone set fire to his restaurant," Brister wrote. Others reported having their boats sunk and cabins vandalized. The netters insisted that cyclical weather patterns, including frigid cold fronts and droughts that raised the salinity levels in the bay, had caused the redfish decline. Their fishing practices were in no way at fault, they said. Some biologists familiar with the controversy agreed with the netters, arguing that TPWD biologists had based their recommendations to outlaw commercial harvest on faulty or incomplete research. There aren't any data to support the ban, Ronald Hilg, a former researcher at the University of Texas Marine Science Institute, told Texas Monthly's Dick Rivas. The problem, I think, is that we have a lot of fishermen who don't know where the redfish are, added Donald E. Wolschlag, the director of the Marine Science Institute. I don't know of any basis for the law. It's a matter of people wanting something done and having the votes to do it. If nothing else, Wolschlag had correctly gauged the political climate. There were only a few hundred commercial fishermen in Texas at the time, a number dwarfed by the hundreds of thousands of recreational anglers. We're going to run out of redfish, warned State Representative Joe Allen, a Baytown Democrat ally of the recreational fishermen. I think it's damn selfish of an industry only generating $2 million a year when the sport fishing industry is bringing in $223 million a year. Gamefish bills sailed through the legislature. In defiance of the new commercial ban, some fishermen persisted for a time. Revis's April 1983 cover story for Texas Monthly titled The New Rustlers chronicled the dying breed of coastal poacher. Many of the netters had already turned to more lucrative careers as recreational guides. Fisherman Ernie Butler put away his nets and bought a small bait stand and burger joint on the intercoastal waterway on the backside of Padre Island, which eventually grew into Snoopy's Pier, a venerable open-air seafood restaurant celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. Likewise, Red Drum have had nearly four decades to recover, a redfish revival widely touted as one of Texas's great conservation victories. Texas has some of the best fisheries there are because of good science and good management, said Greg Stuns, who directs the Center for Sport Fishing Science and Conservation at Texas A&M Corpus Christi's Hart Research Institute for Gulf of Mexico Studies. When he started joining federal commissions and learning about the fisheries in other states, he added, I was surprised how good of a job Texas is doing because some states aren't like that. You go over to Louisiana and the spotted sea trout are in big trouble right now. But the commercial ban and tighter recreational limits are only two components of the redfish revival. A few years before the opening salvo in the redfish wars, the scientists had begun to take a different, and no less ambitious approach to save the fish. Connie Arnold vowed to spawn them in an artificial setting. They were really in trouble, so something had to be done, he recalled. I always had the idea that if you could raise them in large numbers, maybe you could make a difference. In the wild, Red Drum spawn near the mouths of coastal passes from mid-August until the weather cools in October or November. Although no one had been successful in rearing a Red Drum in a laboratory, Arnold thought that he could use the well-equipped National Marine Fisheries Service research facility in Port Aransas, which opened in 1973, to manipulate conditions that induce spawning, primarily by adjusting the temperature of the water and the hours of sunlight in a given day called the photoperiod. That's what triggers it in the wild, Arnold, now 83, told me. I just had to duplicate it in the lab. When it got into their normal photoperiod and temperature, they started chasing each other. To maintain that temperature and photoperiod, lo and behold, they spawned. It was like the redfish could be turned on and off, he said. A breakthrough came on August 14, 1975, when a female redfish in an 8,000-gallon saltwater tank really turned on, spawning up to 5 million eggs, a first for a Red Drum in captivity. One day later, the eggs began to hatch. Over the next several years, Arnold and his team successfully spawned redfish, speckled trout, flounder, croaker, and red snapper, the first natural spawning in captivity for each species. Turned out that redfish and trout, the most coveted of the coastal fish, weren't so tricky to spawn and rear after all. 1979, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department adopted the techniques pioneered by Arnold to stock an incredible 15 million red drum up and down the coast. In the four decades since, the coastal hatchery has shown no signs of slowing. At Sea Center, Texas, in Lake Jackson, one of three state-owned saltwater hatcheries, facilities director David Abrego can manipulate his rotating cast of brood fish to spawn twice per year when he bathes them in 11 hours of daylight and warms them to a temperature of 72 to 73 degrees. Abrego swears he can sniff the air and tell whether a redfish is ready to spawn. You have to be one with the fish, he said during a recent tour. There's an art to it. In fact, there's an easier way to know when the fish are ready to spawn, he noted. True to their name, red drum males make a drumming or knocking sound when courting females. They do this by vibrating muscles against their swim bladder, a gas-filled sac that most fish use to control buoyancy, kind of like fingers rubbing a balloon. Red drum are noisiest after dusk, building toward a drum roll until females release millions of eggs, all of them smaller in size than the average head of a pin. The eggs float to the water surface and in the lab are gently moved to an incubation tank where they mature into fry after a couple of days. Then they're moved again to shallow outdoor ponds where they feast on zooplankton for about a month until the 2-inch-long fingerlings can be released in bays and estuaries to survive or not on their own. Every year, TPWD hatcheries also rear millions of speckled trout. We got it down to a science, Abrego says. But now he has another challenge on his hands. There's a new war rolling coastal fishing communities and involves another popular species in deep trouble in Texas waters, southern flounder. Flounder is both delicious and shaped kind of like a deflated football with oddly positioned eyes that look up from the same side of its face. It typically burrows flat against the floor of the Gulf, watching for prey to ambush. But like red drum and speckled trout 4 decades ago, Stuns says, Texas flounder are struggling. According to TPWD's coastwide test, which the department has conducted since 1982, numbers of juvenile flounder in Texas bays hit all-time lows a few years ago. Dealing with the fishery that just can't handle that kind of fishing pressure, Stuns says. Unlike oil and gas, fisheries renew themselves. If you don't fish them too far down, they'll always rebound in excess, and you can harvest that excess. Flounder don't reproduce fast enough to keep up with our demand. Rising temperatures are one concern, he said. Flounder spawns in November and December during the famous flounder run when water temperatures drop and adults migrate to the Gulf of Mexico to spawn. If temperatures range up or down by more than just a few degrees within the first few delicate weeks of life, the larvae die. For some reason, warmer water also causes more males and females to hatch. The Gulf of Mexico has been warming since the 70s due to climate change. Heaviest pressure is likely coming from commercial harvest rather than sport anglers. Recreational fishing is about the experience, Stun says. Yeah, you keep a few fish, but it's very much resource conservation oriented. On a commercial side, it's how much can I catch and how fast can I catch them and how quick can I go back out and get some more? Because if they're not bringing any fish to the dock, they're not making any money. I recently visited Sea Center, Texas, where lab pumps sock of water through a complex system of tanks and pipes. Several bull reds were swimming in large vats near a smaller tub that teemed with thousands of eyelash-length flounder hatched up 2 months earlier. Unlike more mature flounder, the youngest larva in the incubation tube resemble normal fish with eyes on either side of their head. Older babies were in various stages of a remarkable transformation. Their right eye was drifting over to join the left. It's insane what this fish goes through, says Jennifer Butler, Sea Center Texas biologist. I mean, you go through your first month of life and then all of a sudden everything changes. Your eye shifts and suddenly you have the urge to lie down on the floor. Perhaps owing in part to that complex metamorphosis, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's less luck fine-tuning its flounder hatchery. Flounder also much less fecund than red drum, producing just 100,000 eggs per spawn compared to millions of eggs in each batch from a red drum. We've been working for 10 years, an extremely difficult fish to rear, Abrego said. Later this year, Sea Center Texas is set to open a new laboratory building dedicated entirely to flounder. At their next meeting, possibly as soon as May 21st, if not delayed by the coronavirus, Texas Parks and Wildlife Commissioners are also set to vote on major new restrictions for both commercial and recreational flounder fishing. Females during the fall flounder run, biologists at the state fisheries are recommending that all flounder fishing be closed from November 1st to December 15th. Biologists are also advocating for an increase in the minimum size limit from 14 inches to 15 inches. At 14 inches, just half of female flounder are sexually mature. 1 inch more, and it can be assumed that 90% are mature and have had at least a year or two to spawn. On a calm and clear evening during the annual flounder run in December, Greg Stuns, a couple of his associates from the Sport Fish Science Center, and I piled into his boat and tooled across Corpus Christi Bay. Approaching a few muddy islands about a half a mile off the mainland, the lights of Corpus Christi dotting the horizon to our southwest, Stuns cut the outboard motor and we climbed into the shin-deep water to look for flounder to gig or spear. We were getting an early start, Stuns explained, to beat the competition from professional guides. There's going to be a parade of charter captains tonight. It's like a circus out here. As the sun set over Corpus Christi, we stalked across the clear, shallow flats of the bay with a double-pronged gig in one hand and an underwater spotlight in the other. A stingray flat past the glow of my light. Stuns scanned his spotlight back and forth. I found one, he yelled, calling me over. The shadowy fish had bedded into the silt. Confident, the flounder was well above the legal limit. Stuns gave the word, and I speared my dinner. Blackened. Within the hour, our party of four had gigged our limit of two apiece. As we made our way back to Stuns' house in Port Aransas, we passed several other boats using spotlights to look for flounder. Assuming Texas Parks and Wildlife Commissioners approved the new restrictions, we were among the last Texans to gig for southern flounder during their late fall spawning run. Were the flounder wars about to begin? The battle, Stuns said, was beyond heated. It's boiling. And this article appeared in the Texas Monthly magazine with the headline, Fish Fight, and that's how we'll call it. And I think that brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoons.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Gardening, followed by audiobook news at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
MCH creates phone line for health screening. Medical Center Health System is creating a phone line for patients to call for health screenings when presenting signs for COVID-19. Patients who are experiencing symptoms are being asked to call 432-640-2747. The phone line will be open from 9 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. Monday through Friday, and from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. If you have symptoms when the phone line is not open, patients are being asked to self-quarantine until the following day. As always, if it's an emergency, please call 911. Patients not at risk may be asked to self-quarantine at home until well or able to follow up with their usual health care provider.
Currently airing on the Noon Book Hour, Texas Outlaw by James Patterson. Texas Ranger Roy Yates is not keen for hero status, but it's unavoidable once his girlfriend, country singer Willow Dawes, writes a song about his bravery. Rory escapes his newfound fame when he's sent to the remote West Texas town of Rio Lobo, a municipality with two stoplights, and now, according to the chief of police, one too many Texas Rangers. Rio Lobo Detective Ariana Delgado is the one who requested Rory, and the only person who believes a local councilwoman's seemingly accidental death is a murder. Then Rory begins to uncover a tangle of small-town secrets as crooked as Texas law is straight. To get to the truth before more people die, Rory is forced to take liberties with the investigation. Texas Outlaw by James Patterson, airing now weekdays at noon and repeated at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Tell you a story every man ought to know. If you want a little loving, you gotta start real slow. She's gonna love you tonight now, if you just treat her right now. Oh, squeeze her real gentle, gotta make her feel good. Tell her that you love her like you know you should. 'Cause if you don't treat her right, she won't love you tonight. If you practice my method just as hard as you can, you're gonna get a reputation as a loving man. And you'll be glad every night that you treated her right.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 75 and partly cloudy. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 50s. Then, tomorrow, thunderstorms with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, scattered thunderstorms with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Janet Roberts and I will be reading The Texas Gardener here on Sight Into Sound Radio. From The Texas Gardener, White in the Garden by Dr. William C. Welch continued. Few plants are tougher than the Henry Dulberg salvia that thrives in Texas heat and blooms spikes of blue flowers from late spring through fall. A sometimes overlooked beauty is the white flowering form of Augusta Dulberg. While heat and drought tolerant, they perform best when cut back mid to late summer, which stimulates a beautiful fall display. Small flowering trees can be another opportunity to bring white into the garden. Crepe myrtles come in dwarf and full-size white forms. Flowering dogwood is one of our most beautiful native trees, but only thrives in acidic, well-drained soil. The layer effect of the branching and floral display adds a beautiful touch to any garden. White forms of redbud and Mexican plums add short seasons of color, as well as decorating trunks and stems to our gardens. Natchez crepe myrtles have beautiful peeling bark revealing cinnamon-colored trunks. Severely pruning crepe myrtles results in destroying their natural form, so it is best to only remove crossing limbs and spent flowers. Beware of overpruning, which may result in crepe murder. I hope this survey serves as an inspiration for incorporating white into your own garden while making it a more beautiful and meaningful space for you and your family. From the Texas Gardener, Springtime Means Azalea Time by Keith Hansen. I live in the northeastern part of Texas where pine trees grow like weeds thanks to the acidic soil and high annual rainfall. This combination makes it possible to easily grow a wide range of different kinds of plants that thrive in these conditions, especially azaleas. Starting this month, azaleas become shining beacons of color at home and commercial landscapes all across East Texas. Tyler, where I live, is home to the Tyler Azalea Trails, which draw tens of thousands of visitors every year to tour the miles of brick and paved streets where azaleas grow and bloom in abundance. This year will be the 60th annual event, and it is always worth a trip. However, Tyler is not the only place to see azaleas in abundance. The River Oaks Garden Club in Houston has been featuring an azalea trail for 85 years, which includes tours of the Bayou Bend home and garden, along with other homes and gardens in the area. A relative newcomer to the azalea trail world is located in Nacogdoches, the oldest town in Texas. 2000 marks the first year the Nacogdoches Convention and Visitors Bureau and the Flora Garden Club established the Nacogdoches Azalea Trail with 25 miles of trails through the historical town. But what sets this display apart is the amazing and enormous azalea collection featured in the SFA Gardens on the campus of Stephen F. Austin State University. What began as a vision by Dr. Dave Creech and a graduate thesis project in 1997 has resulted in a first-class garden. What was once a privet-infested bottomland loblolly forest periodically inundated with floodwater from Lanana Creek is now the largest azalea garden in Texas with more than 7,000 azalea bushes along with Japanese maple, dogwood, and camellia companions nearby. Barbara Stump was the graduate student tasked with designing an 8-acre azalea garden for her MA thesis when Dottie Wisely stepped in and provided an endowment to actually create the designed garden. The result is the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden, which was dedicated in 2000 and completed in 2002. There are 46 beds filled with azaleas, camellias, Japanese maples, and many other special plants, accessed by more than a mile of easily traveled paved walkways. Many benches are available for sitting when one may pause to reflect and enjoy the overpowering beauty of so many azaleas of every kind and color. There are more than 550 different kinds of azaleas, 100 varieties of camellias blooming from fall through early spring, and special collections of hydrangeas, boxwoods, Japanese plum yew, and other rare and interesting plants. Also interspersed throughout are hundreds of Japanese maple varieties that compete with the azaleas with their beautiful new spring foliage. Then, in late fall, about the end of November, the Ruby M. Mize garden is transformed in another blaze of color as the Japanese maple put on their end-of-year fall display with yellow, oranges, reds, and purples. Don't think you can tour this garden in half an hour when it is in full bloom during March and April. The winding trails take you through vista upon vista of masses of azaleas in an array of colors and delightful color combinations, making every bend in the trails a Kodak moment. You'll feel like you've left the busy world behind and are immersed in the beauty of nature, surrounded by a spectrum of soft and hot pinks, oranges, yellows, purples, reds, whites, and color blends blooming under the towering canopy of pines and southern sugar maples. The large sweeping beds are organized by azalea hybrid groups, where masses of representative cultivars of each type show you their potential impact if similarly used in your own landscape. You'll find a collection of the rare hang azalea varieties, which were bred in China and brought to the U.S. a mere 40 years ago. There are the groups of early blooming azaleas like the Karoom and Southern Indica hybrids. These will be followed a few weeks later by the mid-season spring bloomers like Robin Hill, Girard, Carla, and Glendale hybrids. Later in May, you'll find the striking Satsuki hybrids. Satsuki means fifth month in Japanese, with a spectrum of hues, sometimes with unusual random patterns of mixed colors in a single bloom. And then there are the taller, growing deciduous azaleas native of North America, sporting fragrant honeysuckle-shaped blooms before the leaves cover the upright branches. Depending on the species or hybrid, their flower color ranges from pale to medium pink, yellow, a color not represented by the Asian evergreen azaleas, tangerine orange, and brilliant red. These are also represented by their hybrid groups, such as the Aromi and Confederate series. Guided tours are available for groups through the garden during the Azalea Trail, and the Ruby M. Mize Garden hosts other events, including a Little Princess Tea Party and an annual Azalea Symposium. In 2011, azaleas in the SFA Gardens expanded with the creation of the Gala Mize Garden right across from University Drive from the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden. SFA graduate Ray Mize urged David Creech, SFA Garden Director, to turn this area into a beautiful garden. Originally called the SFA Recreational Trails and Gardens, it was renamed in honor of Gala Mize, a long-term supporter of Nacogdoches Beautiful and the SFA Gardens. This 8-acre garden continues the tradition of bringing unique, new, or underused, unknown plants to trial and display. Since the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden mainly, but not solely, features evergreen azaleas native to Asia, the emphasis in the Gala Mize Garden will be on the distinctive and beautiful azaleas and their hybrids native to the U.S. These azaleas are deciduous, losing their leaves in the winter and bursting forth with brilliant and fragrant honeysuckle-shaped flowers in the springtime, often before the leaves emerge. Their growth habit, unlike the mounding evergreen azaleas, are upright, letting them shine above lower growing plants. And the flower colors range from pink to flaming red to brilliant golden yellow and blends of all the foregoing colors. In addition to azaleas, the Gala Mize Garden also displays other collections, including crinums, camellias, and a variety of other unique, rare, and special plants. While visiting, don't miss the labyrinth surrounded by a ring of slender silhouette sweet gum trees. Driving down University Drive in the spring, you do not want to miss these two gardens when their signature azalea, Koromo Shibuku, is blooming. They line both sides of University Drive for more than 800 feet. This unique azalea has spider-like light purple petals and was selected because it is close to FSA's school color. If you are planning a visit to Nacogdoches to see these two azalea gardens, check with the Nacogdoches Visitor Bureau. See, timing for the prime bloom period varies from year to year depending